Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Matt Sapinski, and he'll be answering your most important questions on Spring Creek seduction. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Matt a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box there to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within about 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Matt Sapinski about Spring Creek seduction. Watermaster is dedicated to providing their customers with the highest quality inflatables on the market, as well as an unbeatable customer service and product support. They are best known for their signature products, the Watermaster Grizzly and Kodiak rafts. These rafts are lightweight, compact, durable, versatile, and safe. The Watermaster rafts are everything your personal watercraft should be. They have been used by anglers and hunters all over the world for over 15 years, including Dave Whitlock, one of fly fishing's greatest innovators. Dave said, "With my Watermaster, I can enjoy more fishing per hour than any other method I have ever tried. After 2.5 years of testing 15 models of kick boats, I'm convinced that the Watermaster is the ultimate personal flotation craft for warm and cold water fly fishing." Visit Watermaster today and take a look at, as Dave Whitlock puts it, the ultimate personal flotation craft. Go to www.bigskyinflatables.com. That's bigskyinflatables.com. But before we introduce Matt, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. On a drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Matt's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Just click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Matt's book, Selectivity, The Theory and Method of Fly Fishing for Fussy Trout, Salmon, and Steelhead, courtesy of Headwater Books. And to see more about the other books that Headwater has, go to headwaterbooks.com. So to win this incredible book on selectivity, you must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. And the question will be about something that Matt and I talk about during the show. You must submit your answer along with your name and location using the text box on our homepage. Listen closely, take notes, and use your best typing skills, and hopefully you'll win Matt's book. Tonight our guest is Matt Sapinski. Matt is a fly fishing guide, outfitter, instructor, lodge owner and operator, freelance writer and photographer, book author, and culinary trained chef from Michigan. He has been fly fishing since the age of 7, having been brought up in the Niagara frontier of upstate New York and spending time as a boy in Poland. In 1995, he opened his Gray Drake and Trout and Eagle Lodges, which he and his wife, Lori, have been operating for 18 years. He guides clients for trout, steelhead, and salmon 280 days a year on Michigan's Great Lakes, rivers like the Muskegon, Pere Marquette, Big Manistee, and St. Joseph. He has fished from Russia to Europe, the UK, Iceland, and extensively throughout all of North America. Matt's book authorships have been bestsellers and have spanned 16 years. They include The River Journal, Pere Marquette, Steelhead Dreams, and Steelhead Dreams 10th Anniversary Edition, Orvis Guide to Great Lakes Salmon and Steelhead, co-authored contribution to Orvis's ultimate book, Fly Fishing, and also co-authored The Art and Science of Fly Fishing. His latest books include Steelhead Dreams 12-Year Anniversary and current bestseller on Amazon, eBay, and Barnes & Noble, Selectivity. Matt has appeared on national TV and has had 7 cover shots for Fly Fishermen, Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, Fly Fish America, American Angler, and 2 covers on the Orvis Annual Fly Fishing Catalog. He has acted as editor and contributor to several magazines, including Fly Fish America, Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, and Fly Fisherman Magazine. Matt, welcome back to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Good to talk to you, Roger.
Yeah, good to have you back. So last time we talked about your book, Selectivity, and now we're going to push that, I guess, a bit further and talk about Spring Creeks, which to most fly fishers out there is probably the ultimate challenge in selectivity. Would you agree with that?
Oh, there's, yeah, definitely. You know, the thing about Spring Creek is that it scares a lot of people. They get to these pristine, clear, gentle flowing waters, and they see real selective trout, and, you know, they get intimidated by them. Probably the reason why I wrote Selectivity is because I spent so much time fishing Spring Creeks in the Cumberland Valley. When I was in the hotel business in Washington, D.C., and fished Spring Creeks all over the world since then, including England and all over Europe. But they have a special charm. They're very pastoral. They run through beautiful farmland. And, you know, when you get to them, the trout can be extremely fussy, extremely selective. Small flies, tiny leaders, small diameter leaders. They are the PhD level of fly fishing for trout, without a question of a doubt.
So what is a Spring Creek, in contrast?
So yeah, that's a big, loaded question. And, you know, it's amazing how provincial we've been and secular in our thinking of what Spring Creeks are. And this is fairly new because most people don't realize that the history of fly fishing as itself originated on Spring Creeks with Dom Juliana Berners in England on the Hampshire chalk streams. They called them chalk streams, where these are very low-lying pastoral streams that go through main farmland and grazing territory. But in all essence, a spring creek is like the tip of an iceberg of vast subterranean water caverns. And they usually crop up in low-lying valleys. That's why usually, like, you know, the Cumberland Valley, the Driftless area in Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, these low-lying farm country valleys usually have these outcroppings of these underground caverns. Most of them are limestone calcium carbonate caverns that trap water through crevices in the limestone. And, you know, as one of my mentors, Vince Marinaro, he really talks nicely in his book, The Modern In the Ring of the Rise, about the formation of spring creeks and limestone spring creeks in particular, but basically formed from one-cell foraminiferin protozoans that precipitated to the bottom of the ocean millions of years ago through electric lightning storms that formed calcium carbonate, which are coral reefs and calcium, which you'd see when you drive through Pennsylvania, New York. It's different than volcanic rock and other granite and stuff like that that are formed by the convulsions of the plate tectonics. But in all essence, a spring creek is this water emanating from underground caverns. It could be limestone. It could be, like in Michigan, we have spring creeks, and nobody even talks about them being spring creeks, but we are loaded with sandy, chalk stream-like spring creeks, and they emanate through cracks in the earth, and they form, and they stay in the low-lying areas pretty much, very little gradient to them, and they come at a perfect temperature, about 46 to, you know, anywhere from 46 to 55, 56 degrees at a year-round flow of cold, perfect water. You know, I talk a lot about them in Selectivity because they are the ultimate selectivity think tanks for these, you know, thinking anglers that like to sit and ponder their fish with their bamboo rods and their tweed jackets and coats and pursue these fish gently sipping. But, they started in the Hampshire country. Vince Marinaro and Charlie Fox and all the deans at Koch and Harvey and Humphreys in Pennsylvania sort of started the American school of fly fishing past the Catskills. But it started really in earnest with Marinaro in the Ring of the Rise and Modern Dry Fly Code and through those books. That they thought that outside of England, the only place that there were spring creeks were the Cumberland Valley in Pennsylvania, and then they further found out about State College and Penns Creek and Spring Creek. But it's really interesting to note that probably almost every state, except for some of the tropical states down below, have spring creeks of some kind, and they're not always very visible as spring creeks, but they have spring creek influences, spring creek ground flows that come into them, and they could be freestoners, which are runoff streams or accumulation of water space streams, but they have spring creek influences. And tailwaters are, in all essence, giant spring creeks because they're emanating out of big underground, big reservoirs that have bottom draws that pour cold water in. So if you go fish like the Delaware or the Missouri or a lot of these rivers, that they look like spring creeks because they are, in essence, because they get the vegetation growth. So in all essence, spring creek is an underground source of water that doesn't accumulate through a series of rivulets and spate rivers like the freestoners are. It has pretty much a very consistent temperature year-round. The trout, like the Wyoming preacher called them, got special brew for a trout, because if you were a trout, you want perfect conditions. You want a year-round availability of food. You don't have to starve during winter and have anchorites and things like that. So it makes the trout very selective, makes them very snooty, makes them, the slow currents allow them to take their time and inspect their food sources without having to lash out at something going by at 100 miles an hour in a boulder strong river. So that's, in essence, what a spring creek is. But we have several types of spring creeks. Like here in Michigan, our rivers are all pretty much spring-fed, even though they look like freestoners. But they're spring-fed rivers and because of the sand. So sand acts like calcium carbonate, just like in the chalk downs of England. So there's sandy spring creeks, like the Ossabel is one of the greatest spring creeks. And Vince Marinaro, in his last chapter, talked about the Ossabel being one of the greatest spring creeks because it's all accumulation of water percolating through sand and trapping in these underground caverns. So that's, in essence, what a spring creek is.
Okay, so it sounds like in Michigan, because of the sand and so forth, you've got, the makings of a spring creek there. But you also said it sometimes turns into a freestone or wherever, so I guess it determines what kind of area it's in and if there's any slope to it or whatever. But, when I think spring creek, and I don't know, maybe a lot of other people think, slow-moving, very, calm-type water, no riffles per se, these long, lazy kind of rivers. But that's not always the case from what you're saying.
No, not again, exactly. So, you're going to have some spring creeks that do have some gradient that go through, freestone strata, gravel strata. And actually, the best spring creeks are ones that have a little change of somewhat gradient, because one of the biggest problems with spring creeks is they silt in very easily because they're running through pastoral grazing territory of cows and sheep. There's often very little gravel for a lot of wild trout spawning. And what the guys did in Pennsylvania, like Marinette or Charlie Fox, they would make gravel beds to increase spawning potential because they don't flow very fast. So thus, the buildup of silt will clog a lot of the spawning gravel. So in essence, to keep water moving through these spring creeks is actually pretty good. And if you see the work that they did on Nelson Spring Creek in Montana, see the work that they did in Big Springs, Pennsylvania, to try to move the water through areas to create more spawning gravel, because they can become very lazy. And flooding could really devastate them. The rivers can be devastated by flooding like they had on Armstrong's and in Dupuis back when the big floods on the Yellowstone. So in essence, a good combination of spring creeks is sort of a general mix between spring creek influences and some gradient coming from rocky morainal areas that add gravel to them. So that's what we got a lot of in Michigan. Pennsylvania has a lot of that too. Wisconsin, Montana, out west, California, Wyoming. I mean, literally every state you go to has spring creeks. Indiana has spring creeks. Iowa has spring creeks. Iowa, who would you ever think has some of the most incredible spring creeks in the world? Mm. Wisconsin and Minnesota are loaded with spring. There's hundreds upon hundreds and hundreds of pure wild trout spring creeks. So I think our vision of them, and then throughout Europe, too.
Well, this next question, Larry in Longmont, California, his idea is that he wants to know about the regulations for spring creeks. Assuming that there's no high watermark law, how do you get general access? There was another question, Dave in Lakewood, Colorado, along the same lines of public versus private. Do you find that a lot of spring creeks are private, or are there plenty of public ones to be had?
Well, yeah, that's a good question, and that's a combination of both. So when a farmer or a landowner has a spring creek, they're usually highly prized because you can fish year-round, the water temperatures are perfect, and they grow trout very large. So they make them private. Like you have Nelson's Armstrong Decrees, you have a rod fee, you have only 6 or 7 or 8, 10 beats, etc. You charge per rod. That tradition actually started in Europe. So if you look at the test, the Itchen, the Kennet, all those great spring creeks there, you know, it costs somebody $800, $900 some days to fish a spring creek there, fish the prime beats. So spring creeks are highly protected for their private fishing. Now, if you go to Germany, even places in Slovenia, all through Europe, France, their spring creeks are very well protected. They're usually private. They cost money. They usually have clubs, like the Mouche de la Malong Club in Normandy on the Rive de Rive. So, yes, they are private. They usually charge a rod fee. And then you have tons of public access on spring creeks like you do, you know, in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania has so much public spring creeks. Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, tons of open, wide open, catch and release state-sponsored spring creeks. Montana, once again, that's a private situation, a lot of Wyoming, too. But then you have Poindexter Slough right outside of Dillon, which I've had some of the best pale mooring dun hatches, spring creek hatches there, and that's open water. So the unfortunate thing is, yes, a lot of it, they're so highly prized by trout fishermen, and most people make them private, charge a rod fee, start a club, like the Spring Creek Club on Spruce Creek and State College. You know, everybody wants a piece of a spring creek.
Do you see fishing in America going that direction as far as fly fishing goes? Do you see it going towards a European model of pay to play?
You know, it's really interesting, and I travel a lot doing the selectivity clinics and traveling all over, doing a lot of filming now for my new TV series and a bunch of DVDs are coming up, and I'm witnessing an almost reversal in what happened with River Runs Through It. So in America, you're going to find right now that the prized water is going towards a more a private, secular system because there's money to be made. So when there's money to be made and you got a perfect ecosystem like Spring Creek, people are going to take advantage of it. Whereas Europe has always been in that very privatization mode. Like in Germany, it takes almost a year to get a fishing license. You're like, what? A year to... You have to pass exams, you have to learn biology, you have to learn entomology, you have to, theology, I mean, it's amazing stuff. So what I'm seeing right now in Europe probably is the biggest boom in fly fishing going on right now. It's a new renaissance there because there's more public water opening up because the governments have become, a lot of the communist Soviet governments have opened up and become more, you know, liberalized and allowing more people to enjoy, you know, the sport. So you're seeing probably more or less private water in Europe that's opening up to public, whereas here public is turning private, and landowners are, you know, getting sick of people trashing their land and throwing crap and leaving gates open, having cows leaving and sheep leaving. So they privatize them. Now, as far as high water mark, it all depends on per state. So you have the King's Dominion laws of the old provincial laws dating back to, you know, King George, where even in New York State where you have a piece of river like the East Branch of the Delaware where you can't wade it at all. You can't even touch near it, whereas most rivers, as long as your feet is in the water, you're okay. And then you have rivers out in Montana that you could flow through it maybe, but your anchor of a drift boat can't touch the bottom. So every state has their own laws, and mostly spring creeks are tiny enough to privatize them, where they put a barbed wire fence to say you can't go in here no matter what, even if you stay in the water, whereas bigger navigable waters tend to have high watermark laws. So it all depends on the site, but usually spring creeks are very well-protected little jewels that will keep people out if they can.
Yeah, and like you said, navigable is probably a big thing about whether it can be privatized. I know in Colorado, you basically own as a property owner to the middle of the river. So in Colorado, yeah, if you're on private, like when we were fishing the Gunnison River 2 weeks ago, in some areas we can anchor on one side of the river, but not on the other side of the river.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy.
Well, it makes it difficult, you know, especially if you don't know the area. If you're the guide, of course, all the guides know where you can and can't, but if you just come for the day to fish, you really don't know. It makes it difficult. But second part of Dave and Lakewood question was, what's the best way to find the spring creeks if you're seeking them out?
Well, that's a really good question, and usually, you know, I'm fishing right now for summer. I'm guiding out right now for summer steelhead here in Michigan, and I'm guiding out of a, you know, town near called Bering Springs, Michigan. So usually the towns give them away. It's kind of interesting that, you know, it may Boiling Springs, Pennsylvania, where the Yellow Breeches is. Usually the towns in the area, surrounding area, have made a long legacy over the last hundreds of years over that they have springs there. So the best way to, you know, obviously there's so much written about them, so you go online and look up, you know, spring creeks, et cetera. But telltale signs are usually valleys in mountain ranges like the Cumberland Valley, the Shenandoah Valley, the Driftless area. Usually when you find the low-lying areas between higher mountain ranges or hills, you're going to find spring creeks. A good telltale sign, if you see a lot of road signs that say Mineral Springs Road or Lacey Springs Road or blah, 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 I always have the Amish theory as the best way to tell where spring creeks are.
Enough.
Would you like to know what the Amish theory is?
Sure.
Well, if you find Amish, you'll probably find spring creeks, because if you go from Pennsylvania to Indiana to Wisconsin to Minnesota to Iowa to Virginia to Maryland to New York, wherever there's Amish, you will always find spring creeks, because they always, where you have spring creeks, you have the most fertile soil, and you also have the ability for them to build spring houses out of limestone. They always like to construct limestone, and limestone is a, if you find limestone, that's almost 100% indicator you're going to find spring creeks, because they go hand in hand together. Calcium carbonate and spring creeks go together. And they would build their spring houses out of limestone so they could store their commodities, all their provisions of hams and salamis and dried meats in these spring houses, and they never would need air conditioning or for refrigeration. And in the wintertime, the vice versa. So the wintertime, they wouldn't freeze over, so they used spring houses built on top of the source of the spring to put their food that they eat all year, because it would never freeze and it never get too hot. So it was like the perfect, you know, whirlpool refrigerator back when, you know, 200-300 years ago when the Amish came here. So the Amish are, if you find Amish, I could almost guarantee you you're going to find a spring creek in the area. So
there you go, Dave.
There's your answer. Follow the buggies, boys and girls.
Okay. Okay, Matt, let's take a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll talk, dig more into spring creek fishing. Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida and the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help the recovery of rare native trout, the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and is helping to prevent the introduction of harmful aquatic species to new waters with their Clean Angling Pledge. The Federation won a National Conservation Award for its efforts. To continue this great work on behalf of all fly fishers, the Federation needs to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects, and by doing so, give something back to the sport that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to the Federation website at www.fedflyfishers.org. That's fedflyfishers.org. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Matt Sapinski about spring creeks. If you'd like to ask Matt a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. Receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Matt, I always ask my guests at this point in the show, you know, what's going on in your fly fishing world? So you mentioned you're fishing for steelhead this week, so, and what else is happening?
Well, I've been pretty busy doing a lot of selectivity clinics around the country, just been doing some filming overseas for a new pilot series on TV, new selectivity DVD series coming out. I also still guide a tremendous amount, up to 300 days a year for trout, steelhead, salmon. So I'm like constantly on the go, but right now I'm fishing for summer on steelhead on the St. Joe River with my clients, and they're very special fish that they were brought from the Washougal River in the Columbia Valley to Michigan, Indiana. Indiana actually raises them, but they're a beautiful saltwater strain of steelhead that run in the summertime, so you don't have to freeze your buns off, you know, on the Lake Erie tribs in Ontario and pushing snow off your car. Right now we're having heat waves that are giving us problems. But so yeah, I'm a pretty busy guy, but in the selectivity clinics have been doing really well around the country. I'm going to be doing two very special ones coming up in September. One's going to be in the Catskill Mountains. I'm going to be doing a tailwater selectivity clinic. The tailwaters are special to my heart because I guide on the tailwater, the Muskegon. But I fished the Delaware many times. It's going to be at the Delaware River Club with Jeff White. And we're going to hopefully have the guy who did the foreword for my book, Al Cucci, wrote Hashes, and maybe Art Lee make an appearance. And then the second week in September, I'm going to be heading to Pennsylvania, which is also dear to my heart. We got married at the Allenbury on the Yellow Breeches, and I used to fish the Yellow Breeches, Latorte, Big Spring, Falling Spring almost every weekend when I was in Washington, D.C., the hotel business back then. But I'll be working with TCO Outfitters, South of Hawking Creek Outfitters, in Reading, Pennsylvania State College, and Boiling Springs, doing some selectivity Spring Creek clinics. I'm going to do master clinics for people, and then some steelheading clinics, because a lot of Pennsylvanians are really into Steelhead Alley and what Pennsylvania has to offer from a steelheading standpoint, and Elk Creek, Walnut Creek, all the other Isle Creeks. So I'll be a very busy guy in the next couple months. Yeah. So go to the websites and check on the dates that's coming up at TCO Outfitters, TCO Fly Fishing, and Delaware River Club, and I hope to see you out there.
And do you have a website that people can go to keep track of you?
Yeah, it's graydrake.com, graydrake.com, and I post a blog as much as I can almost every other day, so you can go to my blog and check it out, and I'll get more information. We'll be finalizing the details for these two big clinics, so I'll be covering tailwaters, which are giant spring creeks, and then spring creeks and steelhead, which are, you know, all top three very popular topics for trout and steelhead fishermen.
So again, graydrake.com, correct?
Yep. Right.
Okay. All righty. Okay. Let's jump. And you had mentioned tailwater. So Ted Rosenkrantz wrote in. He's from Newington, Connecticut. He says, "What's the difference in food supply, reproduction of native species, and the ability to fish year-round between spring creeks and tailwaters, as they both have fairly constant flows and temperatures?"
Well, that's an excellent question, Ted. And he's from Connecticut, so he probably fished that wonderful Farmington tailwater that they have out there, which I fished last year with Tori and Nanda Sinise and those wonderful people there. But so the one thing about spring creeks is that you have this very good stability because the flows don't fluctuate very much because they're underground flows. The problem with tailwaters is that their flows will fluctuate based on releases. So you have that same problem in the Delaware. You have problems on other rivers that either generate for hydropower or generate from a flood control standpoint. So if you're standing on a big Tennessee Valley Authority, Holston, or Clinch River, they have tailwater releases. So one minute you're in ankle-deep water, next minute you're up to your chest. People drown on those big rivers. The difference in, let me go from the top here, food supply, very, very similar. They tend to favor a lot of detritus-eating mayflies, clinging and swimming mayflies like betis, glowing olives, sulfur. So both those rivers will have a ton of sulfur hatches. The Delaware River has massive sulfur hatches, PMD hatches out west, your pale morning duns, glowing olive hatches almost year-round because they favor alkaline-loving vegetation like Elodius, watercress, duckwort, chara, so they favor those insects. The problem with reproduction of native species, if you have enough gravel in spring creeks, you'll have tremendous natural production like you do on the Isabo, you do in the Wisconsin spring creeks. I mean, the fecundity of those spring creeks is massive because they have good gravel combination with traditional spring creeks. So if you have the gravel, you're going to have mind-boggling reproduction because there's no droughts, there's no heat waves to wash them out, and they run very clear coming out of underground caverns as opposed to runoff. So when trout, brooks, browns, rainbows spawn in spring creeks, they're going to have a very high, you know, 70-80% survival of hatching in those creeks. Tailwaters, on the other hand, due to their fluctuating flows, will have either incredible natural reproduction or abysmal natural reproduction. So you look at the Delaware system, which has more stability for based on because of the Delaware Watershed Council has gotten very good releases, and they have many tributaries to them. They have incredible fertility, but some rivers in the TVA system will have good fertility if they have good tributaries, but if they have just a constant fluctuation and push of water, scouring the bedrock, scouring the bottom of the rivers, they'll have less hatches and less natural reproduction. So it all depends on the stability of the flows of those rivers that'll make the difference.
Okay, great. Andrea in Garrettsville, Ohio, says she's planning a trip to Montana and would like to fish Armstrong Spring Creek, but would prefer to go at a time when it's less crowded. And they'll be spending 2 weeks in the area. Is Armstrong a private or is that a public Spring Creek? Do you know?
That's a private. Armstrong is Armstrong and Dupuis are on the east side of the Yellowstone or north side, whatever you want to call it. And Nelson's on the other side. So, yes, they're private. Yes, they have a rod fee. On my selectivity DVD, I filmed on Nelson's in September, and there was nobody there. So if you want to have some private fishing, everybody wants the PMD hatch there, which is Pale Morning Dun hatch there. And then, of course, terrestrials, hoppers are very big because of all the heat and the low-lying areas. But I would tend to wait as long as you can to later in the year, end of August, September. There's hardly anybody out there. It's tough to fish them because the fish can be more selective, reflective at that time of year because they've seen a lot. But if you have ant patterns and midge patterns and some blueing olives and a few PMDs, you could have a great time there. And when we were filming on Nelson's, we had 2 days there was actually probably nobody on the water. So I would recommend going later in the season after the hatches have occurred, and you'll be able to enjoy a more serene environment.
Great. Rob in Pennsylvania asks, as a novice with many spring creeks in the Pennsylvania area, what advice can you offer for the best time of day / year to fish? Is there any generalizations about that?
That's an interesting question because, you know, they vary so much. I would say that probably if you want to experience spring creeks at their most vulnerable state for the trout to be more active is probably the first hatches of the year in springtime when the early black stoneflies hatch or some of the bigger mayflies, Hexagenia, or green drakes like on Penn's Creek hatch or the sulfur hatch. You have to really time a time where the trout are the most vulnerable, most active is when the sulfurs hatch, when the Dorotheas and Invarias hatch, which is usually May and June. But when there's hoppers in the meadows, when there's beetles in the meadows, when there's ants in the meadows, in the middle of summer in the heat, those trout, when they get cued in on hoppers or cicada or 13-year cicada hatch, it can go crazy. So a big 20-inch brown that's usually really selective, reflective, really intelligent, loses his mind when he's getting big, fat, juicy hoppers coming down the creek. So I would say wait for the heat of summer, wait for the warm afternoons, when the wind is blowing and the farmers are tilling their fields with tractors and blowing hoppers around, and you might see some gargantuan fish that you normally would never fish.
Great. Jamie in New York City asked, how do you rate the Delaware system in regards to some of the toughest fisheries you have fished?
I'd say probably Delaware is by far the toughest. I would equate the Delaware and Silver Creek in Idaho as the two toughest, and, of course, the Latorte in Pennsylvania is the top three most difficult selectivity rivers that you could ever imagine. If you read my selectivity book, I talk at length about this Delaware River system. I talk at length in my we filmed at length in my selectivity DVD about the Delaware system. Delaware system has got such amazing reproduction on brown trout and rainbow trout. It has 160-plus miles of wild trout water, ideal circumstances for mayflies and hatches, obviously, with Alcucci and hatches 1 and 2 and Nastasi. It could be probably one of the finest wild trout fisheries in the world, in my opinion.
Okay. Let's talk about food and flies in these spring creeks for a few minutes. Brian Adams says, what would be the most common bug you'd find turning over rocks in spring creeks that you fish, I guess?
Well, you know, that's one thing interesting about spring creeks is that they attract cold water-loving vegetation, a Okay, so you're going to see a mix of vegetation and gravel, which is perfect for a variety of insects. But if you had two bugs that would characterize most spring creeks are blueing olives and sulfurs, or on the West Coast they call them pale morning duns. If you go back to the spring creek history of England, it's the same thing. They were called pale watery duns and iron blues. So these clinging, swimming mayflies that love the detritus of decaying vegetation, you're probably going to see a ton of. You could always, on any given day, on a cloudy, rainy day, overcast day on a spring creek, 12 months out of the year, you'll find blueing olives hatching. Whether they're betas or the old ephemerellas or pseudocleons, because they like that slower, subtler flows that don't wash them out. And those two will probably be the most prominent. You'll get tremendous caddis hatches because they like some of the gravel and they like some of the siltier areas. In some spring creeks, you'll have burrowing mayflies like brown drakes. On the Henry's Fork, green drakes, Fenn's Creek, hexagenias like spring creeks. The yellow breeches has a lower yellow breeches has hexagenias. So burrowing mayflies that like silt burrowing mayflies will favor them. And then the trichos, which are very tiny mayflies. Almost every spring creek has trichos and on. But if you had two bread and butter hatches, it would most likely be blueing olives, and of course, I missed the most important bread and butter hatch, is midges. Simulium chironomid midges love fecal matter from grazing cows and sheep. They love the decaying detritus. They love the silty environments, and midges, crest bugs, and shrimp, crustacea probably comprise 90% of spring creek diets.
Okay. I was just going to ask you what other food sources, and you said shrimp, crustacea.
Yep.
Okay,
so, well, you can't miss a scud. If you had one fly to fish on a spring creek, it would be a scud.
Okay. Larry in Longmont, Colorado, he says, is there a faster change in hatches and what the fish are striking at in spring creeks than in larger rivers? If so,
there's no real fast change. If you think of spring creeks, think slow. Everything happens at a very slow rate. So going from one, like a masking catch, I talk a lot about masking catch and selectivity. There occasionally in the springtime, you might have some Hendricksons coming off on some spring creeks. At the same time, you'll have midges, and at the same time, you have early black stoneflies coming off. But usually catches happen at a slower duration. Usually not a very blanket hatch, except on some, bigger like trichos. Like trichos on Silver Creek could be massive, or on Spring Creek or the falling springs used to have trichos. But they tend to evolve slower. They tend to last in duration for a longer period of time because they don't have short windows of temperature-based opportunity that freestoners have. So freestoners will go from 55 degrees to 64 degrees in a very short period, and then they might warm up to 74 degrees, and then with a couple of cold nights in the fall, it will cool up. So you have more volatility in hatches that happen at a very fast pace. The spring creeks tend to meander and wax and wane and meander, just like the water, just like the fish. Everything has to slow down when you fish a spring creek.
Yeah. Let's take a quick break. And then I'll ask, looks like a very good question coming up here from Jim Bissell in Cincinnati. So I hope you're listening, Jim. I'm anxious to hear the answer myself. So we'll be right back. Captain Bob Jaspers of Flats Time Charters will introduce you to the Mosquito Lagoon, Indian River, and No Motor Zone of the Banana River on the east coast of Central Florida. Only a short drive from Orlando, you will sight fish for big redfish, spotted sea trout, and black drum, as well as a seasonal snook and tarpon. Captain Bob is a lifetime resident of the area, and it shows in his knowledge of the local fish, flora, and fauna. Call Flats Time Charters now and arrange your next memorable adventure. You can call Captain Bob Jaspers at 321-631-4051. That's 321-631-4051. Or go to his website at flatstime.com. That's FLATS. TIME.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Matt Sapinski about Spring Creeks. If you'd like to ask Matt a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, Matt, good question coming up. I have this from Jim Bissell in Cincinnati. I have this preconceived notion that selectivity means that I need to tie and have on hand 1,000 flies of every shape, size, and color. Are there a few simple guidelines or principles that can negate the need to find that one fly in a haystack of thousands? And the second part of that is he primarily fishes tailwater. So can you help him out and the rest of us with an answer?
My theory of selectivity, I think I revolutionized that. You know, my mentor in Michigan was Carl Richards, who was a dentist, and I fished with quite a bit, him and Dick Spokes, on the Muskegon River. They wrote Selectivity with Swisher and Selective Trout with Swisher Richards. I basically said selectivity occurs all the time through my aggressive, active, selective, reflective, and passive dormant states. So trout are in a constant state of selectivity. But what I like about Jim, who's in Cincinnati, who I bet you fishes the Brookville tailwater, probably in Indiana. That's a new up-and-coming tailwater. But keep it simple and stupid, okay? So that's what everybody wants to do today. We're dumbing it down more than ever and ever. So you read a complex book like Selectivity, and you say, oh, my God, he's driving me crazy with all that junk. So the bottom line is what I'm going to tell you is that simple guidelines revolve around a little bit of research on your part. You could get away with one or two patterns on a consistent basis. I talk a lot in that article I think you read, Roger, called A La Carte Spring Creeks and Fly Fisherman Magazine.
Right.
I talk a lot about PFP. What the hell does that mean? Predator foraging profiles of trout. So on any given stream, a trout's predator foraging, what he must do every day to maintain his metabolic balance of food in, food out, caloric intake, caloric outtake, he's going to concentrate on a certain form of food. So you can best assure that if you fish a spring creek, if you had scuds and blueing olives, you probably would match the underwater feeding activity of a trout and then the surface feeding activity of a trout. You could dumb it down by knowing per, like, freestoners, if you had an Adams and a pheasant tail, and the same with a spring creek, you could just have a pheasant tail and a blue tail. You could dumb it down to two or three pattern variants based on the most abundant food source of the predator foraging profiles of these trout. So if you don't want to carry, you know, a dozen patterns or 900 patterns like I have in my book, you could narrow it down to what is the most available and what is the most consistent bread and butter of the predator foraging profile of that fish at that time of year. And then again, you have to realize that you have spring, summer, winter, and fall in these spring creeks. So wintertime, there's very few hatching. It's going to be scuds and midges. Springtime, it could be blueing olives and sulfurs. Summertime, it's going to be terrestrials. All you need is one bug, a hopper, or an ant. And then I could say right now, throughout summer on any spring creek, if you had an ant, it's all you need. And when I filmed on Nelson Spring Creek, they were taking midges, they were taking blue owls, but if you put a nice, juicy, fat foam ant on these fish, bingo, you could just have one pattern in your box, and it's called foam ants, and you'll take the most selective fish. And everybody likes ants, and there's something about ants that a good friend of mine that when I belonged to the Capital Chapter of Trout Unlimited in Washington, D.C., Ken Miata, who drowned in the bighorn, he wrote an article about ants and why ants are so juicy and why trout love juice. There's something that, you know, Chernobyl ants, you got all kinds of ants. You talk to a guide out west and there's all like fishing ants. There's something about an ant. I don't know if it's the taste, the acidity, the caloric value. It's interesting how ants could be your tell-all to all your problems. So you can narrow it down. You don't need 10,000 pets.
I'll ask this in a second here. Question came, what are the most important aspects for the flies that you use in spring creeks?
Well, and
I'm getting at that. In your article, you were talking about, you know, whether you use any flash or beads or that kind of stuff. So it's kind of what I was.
Yeah, that's a good question. You're going to want to get away from flash and beads and things like that, because those are usually patterns that we design for very fast flowing freestoners, where fish need to get something to their attention of their eye. The moment you come within 50 feet of a spring creek, the trout are going to know you're there. You're stomping your feet, you're walking, you're pounding on this porous, damp soil. You don't need an invitation. They're going to know you're coming the moment you slam your car door. So the best thing that you could possibly do with fly pattern is minimalism, simplicity in terms of sleekness and design and silhouette, but extreme accurate detail. So you'll find out that spring creek patterns are almost exact replicas of what you need to fish, and need to be sparse and very sleek and ride well and look almost as close as the realistic pattern you can. So spring creek patterns are going to cause you to tie very, very detailed imitations of what the trout are feeding on.
Okay, and more natural, yeah, without the flash and so forth. Okay,
right.
Bob in Maryland asked, what's your opinion on skating spiders for spring creek trout?
You know, that's a good question. The spiders, you know, it was Hewitt on the Neversink, where we have a summer home on, which I love to spend a lot of time on, started the whole spider craze. A lot of the spiders were actually created by Halford and Skews in a lot of their dry fly patterns on the spring creeks and the Test and the Itchen, which were very strong flowing spring creeks, chalk streams. Skating spiders could be very attractive to fish that have been picked over very hard, that have seen a lot of perfect imitation flies. One of the biggest problems that I find with skinning spiders is you're going to get a lot of looks, you're going to get a lot of follows, you're going to get a lot of trout that say, I want that, but something's just not right. And then there's going to be times where your perfect ant or your perfect sulfur, your perfect BWO is refused, and then you put on something stupid like a big royal wolf or a big skating spider, you could pick fish off. I would say that don't rule these things out. And it depends on the intelligence of the fish. If you're fishing for stock trout, they'll be more apt to take skating spiders. If you're fishing for, if Bob's in Maryland, I bet he's fishing the Beaver Creek and all these other little beautiful spring creeks that Maryland has. They have natural reproduction there on browns. A lot of the big rainbows are a little more, they're almost all stocked. It's the pedigree of the trout that will dictate whether he wants the spider or not. And if you're fishing over Latorc fish that, you know, has an extreme pedigree of wildness, they might just say, what, you shit me? Are you crazy? Are you going to actually throw that thing at me? So there's so many factors that go on there. But the bottom line is, when the perfect imitation natural fails, skate a spider, skate a wolf, skate a hopper. I mean, there's no prescription for failure, because at any given time, a fish will blow your mind and do something absolutely crazy that makes no sense to what should be happening.
Yeah. So here's a question I have, and just talking about trout, forget steelhead, salmon, and everything else, but just about trout, how do you organize your fly boxes?
Well, I try to organize them by species. So big mayflies, I have a glueing olive box, I have a scud box, crest bug scud box, I have a nymph box. You know, being a guide in my Patagonia bag that I just got done packing before you called me, I got like 50,000 fly boxes. So the problem is, the more crazy you get into this, the more you do it. But, you know, you organize your fly box, and my fly boxes are messes usually because I got so many, I got zillions of flies. I'm always trying to get fish, you know, so people...
Yeah, I asked the wrong guy.
you are terrible. Look at all your flies. They're a mess. I go, but I have every single fly that you'll ever have, and I carry my fly tying kit with me everywhere I go. So in my jet boat, I have my vices, and I have fly tying kits. But how do you organize them? By your destination. So I have my Delaware box. I have my Silver Creek box. I have my Latorc box. I have Mission box, and I would say... The most important thing, we try to generalize everything and try to dumb it down and make it stupid, simple and stupid, keep it K-I-S-S. So look, study your ecosystem very thoroughly. That's my whole theory of selectivity is, if you know your ecosystem, you know your habitat, you know the strains of fish that you have in there, and then you know something about the food, the predator foraging profiles of these fish, you can narrow it down to two or three or four important patterns to have, and your organization should be bent around season. So this is my winter Spring Creek box, which is going to be all midges and scuds and crest bugs and pheasant tails. Then my spring box is going to be different. Then my fall box is going to be different. I would organize them by seasons and food sources. Or if you just put all your dries, you know, the world has become so complex. Fly fishing world has become so complex. I mean, if you look, you know, back 100 years ago, we were primitive. We were Neanderthal man compared to what we are today. And now we're like, oh, my God, this, you know, you look at Hairline's catalog, Wopsy's catalog, everything coming out. I just tied a new Mysis shrimp on my website that people are losing their minds because we're getting all these new scud backs from Kylie Scud Back and in England. And that's a big question, but you could narrow it down. And what I like about Tom Rosenbauer at Orvis, he's always tried to keep it simple and stupid, dumb it down, make it easy, you know, just, you know. And then there's, what's his name on the Delaware? Ed Van Putt, who only fishes a box of, you know, Adams parachutes from a size 8 to a size 22. And that'll sum up everything you need to do. And he catches fish. We can make it as complex as we want to. And that all revolves around your need for mental and cerebral massaging.
Yeah. I'm looking at next week I'm going to be interviewing Charlie Craven, and I'm looking at his new book, Tying Nymphs. So I think he's got like 21 patterns he goes through here. He's basically teaching skills, fly tying skills with these. But then at the back he has what he has designated as the top 30 nymphs. So right there's over 50 nymphs, and just nymphs.
In his one book. 300 nymphs, no?
Yeah, so... yeah, it does get a little crazy, but then again, you know, when I was, like I said, over on the Gunnison a couple of weeks ago, I think, you know, we probably used only 6 different flies in 2 days, you know. They were producing, and they were matching the hatch, and that's what we did, you know. You really didn't need a lot. You just need to know what was going on in the river at the time. And that's kind of what you're
saying. Well, it all depends on what your outcome you want to achieve. So what I do a lot of times is I'll go, I know I have the flies that will basically catch them. If I didn't have selectivity, I would probably be spending all my time on a golf course or a tennis court or something. I'd be bored so quickly. People tell me that, you know, oh, you catch 100 fish. If I caught 100 fish, I would be bored out of my mind. I love to get butt kicked by a little 8-inch wild brown trout giving me the finger every time I throw a size 24 midge at them, and I might have to go down to 26 or 28 and then go down to 8. It all depends what your need for your mental, you know, satisfaction level comes down to. So if you need 2 or 3 flies and you want to simple it down, God bless you. If you want to up it up and make it more complex, but I will tell you something. You could go and fish your Adams every day and you'll have a good day once in a while. But I guarantee you, I'll have 40 patterns that when I need them, they're going to be in my back pocket, and I will destroy the guy who only fishes an Adams or a Zug Bug or a Prince Nymph because I'm going to match the hatch. I'm going to be there at the right time. I'm going to understand a predator foraging profile. And as a guide, I make money by putting fish in the net. So I better be prepared all the time, like a midget at the urinal, always on your toes. You have to be prepared. And if you're not prepared and you don't do your homework and you don't know what's going on, you're going to come home and say, geez, I should have tied these flies and those flies. All depends on what you need for satisfaction.
Yeah. In your article on Fly Fisherman, you wrote a bit about habituation. And can you talk about that and how we can use that to our advantage as fly fishers?
Yeah, well, you know, all animals habituate. So when your dog, we talked about, you know, and in my book I talk about, you know, your dog sits on the couch. You got a wonderful, you know, lab or whatever dog you have or, you know, I have a Hungarian Beagle, so he knows that the doorbell on the TV is not the same doorbell that the doorbell that the UPS guy rings. So he habituates to a sound of a doorbell, and he knows that the doorbell coming out of TV on a commercial is not the UPS guy that he wants to go rip his brains off, okay? So habituation is a, all wildlife habituates to things. So habituation is the threat by some stimuli, whether it's a sound or a vibration or a bird flying overhead. I'm a trout in the stream, also I see a big giant heron fly over me, I go freaking out, okay? Once I perceive the threat as not being a non-threat, then I habituate and assimilate to that threat. So I took a lot of psychology courses in college, so I love the habituation, so assimilation, et cetera, et cetera. But so in Spring Creek world, so a wild trout, a little guy 4 or 5 inches on the littoral, sees his first angler stepping into the river, coming close to the river, freaks out, oh my God, that's terrible. Or the first cow walking through a Spring Creek freaks this little trout out and makes, oh my God. But then in my book I have the story of Skelly's Meadow, where the trout habituated to, at 4 o'clock every day, old man Skelly would march his cows through the meadow and know when the cows were coming through, and the trout habituated to the time of day based on the sun level, that when those cows came plowing through that river to go back to the barn for feed, they dislodged tons of nymphs and scuds below them. So if you were there at 9 in the morning, there wouldn't be a trout to be found. But they, by 3:30, they started lining and queuing up like people at an ice cream stand, knowing that I'm going to get fed. So habituation is the response to what is a perceived threat that becomes the normal, and that normal is the new norm. And that will only change if the threat perception changes. So I know that sounds pretty complex, but that's basically what habituation is. And Spring Creek trout are, you could stand, or the San Juan, I talk about the San Juan, you could stand there and do the shuffle, and they come to your laders, then you're going to dislodge the worm. Or on a Spring Creek, you'll stand in the middle of the river, and you wade, and all of a sudden trout come to your waders, real wild trout, because you're dislodging, you know, ephemeral nymphs, you're dislodging scuds. So habituation is that shark and mora, symbiotic relationship, and that's what habituation is.
Yeah, you're talking about the San Juan. Yeah, the first time I experienced that, I was kind of amazed. I just kind of looked down, and all of a sudden there's like 6 20-inch trout right behind me, you know. And I guess, smart. Yeah. You're not going to. But that's exactly what's happened is they know that they can come up there and do that because they're not going to get caught. Nobody's going to net them or spear them or anything, you know. So they're safe there, you know, and they just take advantage of the situation.
Exactly. It's a fun thing to experience. I mean, that's the beauty of wildlife, of nature, that you're part, you become, as an angler, you become part of that world, which is really cool.
Yeah. Paul Salmons in Texas asks, what's the most important aspect of fishing Spring Creeks versus other types of water?
If I had to put my finger on it, and I'm going to try to keep it simple and stupid, is basically the most important thing about Spring Creek is you better slow down. Slow everything down. Slow your approach. Slow your profile. Keep a low profile. Lighter, smaller flies. Silhouette of flies. Smaller tippets. Think that you're just not going to walk in and just start slaying fish, and you have to observe nature, you have to observe the trout behavior. I think that is probably the most important thing of Spring Creek versus other type of waters, is that you're dealing with a very sophisticated, selective fish that has seen it all, has tons of time to approach your fly because of the slowness of the current, has great visibility because of the clarity of the water. So everything has to be right, and you better be on your game.
Best time of this is from Mike Abramowitz in Maryland. Best time of day to fish a Spring Creek?
That again comes down to the time of year. So in the wintertime, I'd say afternoons when the water warms up, you might, in a cloudy day, you might have a blueing owl hatch in the middle of wintertime. But the midges on Spring Creeks, if he's in Maryland, he's probably fishing the Cumberland Valley Spring Creeks or Beaver Creek in those areas, which I know very well, since I lived in Washington, D.C., and used to fish them all the time. In the afternoon, midges hatch, so you want to be there in the afternoon. Later in the summer, when it gets really hot over there, you want to be there in the water in the morning where trichos are out, but then later in the afternoon when the heat picks up, you get hoppers, ants, beetles, so it all depends on the time of year.
Yeah. We got a question in on the internet here from Noah in Carlisle, and he says he resides in the Cumberland Valley. He says, I'm surrounded by many spring creeks. I'm sure you have fished the valley spring creeks many times. I was wondering if the fishing in these creeks differ from other spring creeks in the country, and if so, how?
Well, that's a good question. Those creeks have gone through massive transformation based on the fact that, you know, when I started fishing those spring creeks back in the early 80s, there was very little population out there. There was very few people. Most of the farms now are big strip malls with, you know, Home Depots and things of that nature. So those creeks now have become ultra, ultra selective reflective fisheries that you better have your game plan on. You better know if they have wild fish in them, they're going to be ultra selective. If you want to up your game in Spring Creek fishing, Cumberland Valley is a great place to go because they have wild browns, wild rainbows, wild brook trout on the big spring. These fish are extremely selective. They'll take midges, they'll take big hoppers, they'll take, you know, it's the Augusta of golf courses as far as Spring Creek fishing is concerned. And then at times they'll be very dumb and take a fly because they need to eat, or they take a big sculpin when they need to eat. So you have to be very well versed when you fish the Cumberland Valley Spring Creeks.
Okay. Dan in Sunnyvale, California, wrote in and says, presentation and drag free drift are critical in Spring Creeks. That's a given. There are so many brands of nylon mono leaders and tippet with different stiffness, knot strength, et cetera. It is impossible to know the truth behind the marketing with, you know, Maxima, Orvis, Rio. Can you give any advice on actual differences between the materials out there and how you choose?
You know, that's, geez, I mean, Orvis makes great, Rio makes great leaders, Maxima, there's so many great leaders out there, scientific anglers. The rule of thumb is if you're going to be fishing dries, you need mono all the way to your tippet. And then your tippet could be fluorocarbon, but you need mono to float it. And then before the fly, you know, I use 4 to 5 feet of tippet, sometimes up to 7, 8 feet on some of the bigger spring creeks and tailwaters of fluorocarbon that will be suspended and held by the mono. But don't fish a total fluorocarbon leader because they'll sink. Stiffness, every single, you know, I'd say two or three companies probably make all the leader materials around. I'm a big, big fan of a leader material called Varivas, V-A-R-V-I-A-S. It's very supple. It comes in different colors. It blends in very well. I think it's Angler Sport Group that carries it. But, yes, it's definitely Bill Chase Area Angler Sport Group. But these are very subtle. They make these very technical 15-footers, 18-foot leaders, 12-footers. You got to get down skinny when you're doing that. Okay, next part of that question.
Yeah, he says, is there a difference between fly and spinning mono? And then what is your leader tippet set up for spring creeks?
My leader set up for spring creeks is, in my selectivity book, I have a concave-convex taper, which is sort of the concept of a double taper where I start out, you know, 023 or 021 or et cetera, and if you buy my book, the formulas are in there. I'm not trying to plug my book, but it makes it a lot easier. But I try to give it sort of a double taper, so I start out very strong and then wait for it, 023, taper it down to like 017. These are diameters. And then bump up a middle section like a double taper would have, like back to 019, and then I would drop it down to 015. So it allows a kicker in the leader, sort of like a kicker, that allows the long, you know, I fish, my small leaders are 12 to 14 foot. My big leaders are almost 18, 20 feet. And people say, how the hell do you turn those over? By a complex system where you have a concave, convex system where it adds diameter, shortens diameter. It's all in the book. That's all I can tell you.
Yeah. Too much to cover here tonight.
Too much.
Stuart in Chicago, I've noticed in a number of small and gin clear creeks that the fish will bunch up in pods at the deep end of a pool. Seems like the perfect spot to nab a few, and yet not a squat zip. They don't spook. I'm well hidden. Throw the usual suspects, pink squirrels, scuds, nymphs, and for grins, yellow fox or leeches. not a take, a twitch, or a nice flash. Usually springtime, sunny day, and 50 degrees. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, he mentioned he's from Chicago, so he's fishing the driftless area, Spring Creek, so those wonderful timber coolies, all the spring coolies, Kickapoos, pink squirrel. That was a giveaway, Stuart. Excellent question. usually springtime, sunny day, and 50 degrees. You're probably going to get a Hendrickson hatch. You're probably going to get an early black stonefly hatch. You're probably going to get a caddis hatch. The fish, the beauty of those Wisconsin spring creeks, the Minnesota spring creeks, is they open. They have a true trout schedule, you know, and they have an early opener now, March, and they're changing some of the regulations around. But usually that early springtime period, sunny day, 50 degrees, I'd be like a Cheshire cat and be having a big smile and saying, you're probably going to have a damn good day because these fish went through a long winter. They see these big, juicy Hendricksons coming down or blueing olives coming down or a big black Mother's Day caddis coming down. He probably knows the answer just by that question.
Okay. Danny Buchanan in Tahoe City. I struggle with the ability to make a stealthy enough approach and cast to feeding fish. Any pointers?
Slow down. Slow down, and I'm going to have you three answers. Slow down, slow down, and slow down.
Slow down.
Keep a profile. Don't cast. When guys fish spring creeks, they come out there and they just want to cast and cast. If you want to cast, go to a big freestone or wait out there and cast your brains off. When you come to spring creek, every cast matters. Just think of it that sometimes I go to spring creek and I say, I'm only going to make five casts. And those casts better be on target. They better be at the right time. Measure the fish's feeding interval of these rise forms. These are PhD little creeks, and you better be on your game and et cetera.
Ari in Encino, California. Sometimes, usually during the fall, I find trout feeding on very small bugs like pseudos or trichos. And many times the trout are just sipping in pods, barely poking their noses through the surface film. The rise swarms are regular, look very deliberate and easy, like they are not chasing the food but rather taking it as it floats by. I'm guessing they are rising on emergers, but when I look at the water, there are bugs that are size 38. If I throw my smallest size 28, it gets laughed at like it's debris. I may catch one or two fish, but how do you approach these selective trout?
Sometimes you have to realize that nature is more powerful than you, and you're not going to imitate a size 38 white midge like I tried to do and bang my head against the wall when I fished the Allenberry in August. Sometimes you're going to have to realize that the natural world has flies that are smaller than, you know, 28. I mean, you really don't know when you really need to fish a 28 anymore. I mean, 24 hooks actually have the same diameter now, the new specialty hooks that Daiichi comes out with. So sometimes you realize that I have this Daphnia hatch on the tailwater that I fish. These Daphnias are like, they're a size 48, okay? So I have to realize that I'm not going to be able to make that happen. Sometimes the best thing that you can do, and this is an excellent question, trichos you can imitate, pseudos you can imitate. They're potting up. They're sticking your nose out. I might catch one or two fish. I'm looking at his answer, but how do you approach these selective trout? Sometimes the keep it simple stupid fly works when something, an ant. I would say an ant. If I had one fly to fish when this crazy selectivity, reflectivity state is going on, and I experience it all the time. I experienced on Nelson Spring Creek when he did his talk to UDB. A small ant and an orange ant. I have a whole chapter in selectivity about orange ants, little tiny ants. There's something that even if the smallest, tiniest midge that a trout is taking, he will go move towards an ant, whether a big ant or small ant. So I'd say fish an ant. God bless you.
Okay. Justin in Rockford, Illinois. He says, I fished a spring creek in northern Michigan over the weekend and got my butt kicked. Any help would be nice. Is it slow down, slow down, and slow down?
Northern
doesn't hurt, right?
but I can't imagine got my butt kicked. If he fished it over the weekend, he's probably dealing with high water temperatures. He's probably dealing with drought. We've had a lot of droughts. We've had a lot of heat. The water's lower than I've seen, so it depends on the time of year. So if you don't have ideal conditions, fish don't need to feed. Fish, you know, fish are conserving metabolic intake, outtake, caloric intake, outtake. So if you got your butt kicked, try to get to them when they're in their best condition and go from there and just learn more about that creek, learn more about what specific insects, invertebrate, macroinvertebrate food forms are in the creek, and that's your best bet.
Andy in Easton, Pennsylvania, wrote in and he says, I found a special place where cold underground springs, spring runs, and several wild trout hang out in groups. I'm trying to learn how to catch them with my Tenkara rod, but must learn a lot. Do I have to have clear, level line and tiny tippet, et cetera, or can I use a more visible leader that casts better? How invisible do I have to be?
You're probably going to have to be pretty invisible if you're near cold water springs and several wild trout hanging out. Tenkara is a great method because you could skitter the fly, similar to riffle hitching for Atlantic salmon, which I just did on the Big Lox River. And I said, the bottom line is, if you have longer leaders, you don't need a clear fly line. It's all about leader length and diameter, and whether it's fluorocarbon or mono. How invisible do I have to be? Well, you have to be pretty invisible, because if you're dealing with wild trout, they're underground springs, they're in a mode where they're being conserving energy, they're looking at everything very selectively, reflectively, they're looking at things coming by. You're going to have to be very stealthy, your program, but Tenkara rods are great. I just got a new rod by Joe Gutspeed at TNT. It's an 11 foot 3 inch weight, and I'm using it as a Tenkara method with a reel. So one of the great things about having a reel on a rod is that you can get a big fish in the backing. But you do have to be very cognizant of your line. But you could have an orange line, but if you have a 14-foot leader and you're tipping it, and the fish ain't going to see 14 feet up and see that orange or green line. Okay.
James in Alpine, Wyoming, says, so I'm on a local public spring creek trying to crack the hatch code on some fish that I'm pretty certain are taking size 16 olive dun caddis emergers. I tried dead drifting and swinging various styles of caddis emergers. I changed styles of flies, bead heads, CDC short wing emergers, and foam backs with no luck. Thought I was covering the various feeding levels in the water column, but was still skunked. Please describe your caddis system that you employ on spring creeks to crack the code. What am I missing? From my fellow Polish anglers are the best in the world.
Dziękuję bardzo, pan. So, as fellow Pole, caddis trichoptera, the biggest problem we have with them, we dead drift them, and we think we're going to dead drift things. And I have a method called, the method called Tenkara caddis or Statue of Liberty caddis, which I talk about selectivity. But it's basically keep your adult fish of tandem rig. We're allowed to have an adult, CDC caddis, Hellcare caddis, whatever kind of caddis you want to have a trailing shuck, a burnt tail, the Carol Richards burnt tail shuck, and imitate the females that are coming back to lay eggs or dive under. So some of the females lay their eggs on top, bounce, 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 and then they dive underwater, and they go down to the bottom, and the fish are taking them up. The best way to fish caddis is throw the line downriver as much as you can and walk up river with your fly rod underneath your arm, and you'll probably catch a fish. People say, oh, are you kidding me? No, because you're imitating a moving, skittering, bouncing, jumping, diving caddis. If you're dead drifting, unless you're taking emerging caddis in the film, they want movement. And the biggest problem most guys have is they don't fish enough movement. They fish a caddis like a mayfly. I've gone to the Missouri, I've gone to other rivers and fished the caddis with the bouncing, Tenkara, high-sticking, skittering Statue of Liberty caddis and crushed fish, while other guys were like saying, what the hell are you doing? Well, you got to understand the way these insects behave, and the more movement, the better.
Yeah, yeah. I guess think about all the times that you've caught fish while you were trying to straighten out your line at your reel or something.
The best time I catch fish is when my wife is screaming at me, or one of my old girlfriends in the past screaming at me, Jesus Christ, you told me you're going to only have one more cast, and we're sitting here for 3 hours, and you said, and I'm trying to figure out this very selective feeding fish on Bard Parker Pool in Delaware, and I talk a lot about it in selectivity, but I'm walking back, and I'm getting so pissed off that I could only make one more cast, and I promised her an hour ago that I would make one cast. And I'm walking back to the bank, and I'm reeling my reel up, and all of a sudden I slam a fish,
yeah.
The one that I'm looking for, because I imitated a caddis that was diving up to the surface and crawling.
Yeah.
So a lot of it's stupid, being at the right time and right place.
Yeah. Kent in Missouri asks, how do you make presentations under overhangs in fast water?
You have to learn how to single spay cast, so... If you come to some of my selectivity clinics, we talk a lot about single spay casting, and anywhere from a 7-foot three-weight rod to an 11-foot two-weight rod, three-weight rod, you have to learn that little simple double spay with the rod tip close to the surface of the water, or a little snap T, single-handed snap T double spay cast. You could fish any tiny rivulet, spring creek, that's 4 or 5 feet wide with any length fly rod, if you know the discipline of single-handed spay casting. And that's the most important thing for small stream spring creeks. So you can throw that fly, tuck it under a branch that's 6-8 inches above the water, and tuck it right in where you want to have it.
Bob in Livingston, Montana. Spring creeks can be tough. It's better in most cases to, is it better in most cases to cast directly at a sighted fish or try casting above it and mending for a longer drift to the fish? Longer drifts are difficult to do with conflicting currents and lighting.
Livingston, Montana, you're probably fishing Nelson's Armstrong, Dupuis. You know, those creeks are extremely clear. Upstream casting is really futile, a lot of those creeks. And when Halford and Skews on the Chalk Strings of England started dry fly fishing, they basically talked about upstream casting the dry flies. Now everything is a down and across reach cast, downstream, keeping a low profile, because what a fish doesn't want to see is your butt of your leader or the main section, middle section of your leader coming into the fish's window. They want to see the fly only. So the only way you can really present that is an upstream reach cast. So I would recommend upstream reach cast, which counterclockwise mends upstream and downstream. Long leaders, let the fly come into the fish's window, and you'll be more successful.
There you go. A couple more on the Internet here. James up in Wyoming, I hope you got enough to answer your question there, because that could be a long answer, and we're out of time. But we do have one more question online. Larry wrote in, he says, my only interest in spring creek fishing is the excuse to buy, a bamboo rod at one weight. What should I buy? Money is no object for my wife.
God bless her.
Yeah. His wife is going to be on the open market here. Yeah.
If you're going to buy a bamboo rod, I'd say 4 or 5 weight would probably be your best. I mean, you go lighter. It depends on what fisheries you're fishing, little tiny spring creeks that have like 7-8-inch brookies and some of the... On the Asabo or in Wisconsin, you might want to get a 3-weight or 4-weight, but a 4 or 5 weight will allow you to fish a bamboo rod on any spring creek in the world, whether it's England, whether it's the United States, whether it's Slovenia. It's going to give you that little extra punch. And remember, you know, these rods are very flexible. They're very slow cast. They're very long flex. And you could get away with a little more heavier weight because your tips and your midsection is going to flex more.
Yeah. Good. Well, that's about all we have time for here, Matt. So we'll wrap things up here. Stick with me, Matt. We're going to give away your book here in a few minutes, and I'm going to ask a question. I want to make sure I get the right answer with you. And we're also going to be giving away 1-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and also a year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So stick with us. You may have a chance to win a copy of Matt's book, Selectivity, and courtesy Headwaters Books. So stay with us a few more minutes, and we'll give those prizes away. A mining company called Pac Rim Coal is planning a massive strip mine near Anchorage, Alaska. The Chewitna Coal Project would be the first project in Alaska history to mine directly through salmon habitat, the Chewitna River drainage, 11 miles of it. Critical commercial, sport, and subsistence fishing economies would be permanently destroyed. Pac Rim says it can rebuild a salmon string, but scientific experts can find no example where successful restoration has occurred after strip mining. Chewitna coal would be shipped to Asia, leaving Alaska with nothing but devastated habitat and ruined salmon runs. It's time to stop the Chewitna coal strip mine. For more information about how you can help, go to Chewitna.org. That's C-H-U-I-T-N-A.org, Chewitna.org. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave our website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We really appreciate it. But now it's time to give away a few prizes. Let me get the database going here real quick, and we'll do our drawings. And our first drawing is going to be for a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And if you're not familiar with Federation, go to their website, fedflyfishers.org, and you can read more about them there. As you heard in the advertisement earlier, they're involved in a lot of conservation efforts in cold water, warm water, and salt water. So give them a look-see. So our winner for that is Bob Heptenstall in Alberta, Canada. So congratulations, Bob. Let me jot down your name here real quick. Heptenstall in Alberta. And so congrats on that, and we'll email and get your information after the show. Now the second drawing we're doing is for a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, courtesy of Amato Books. And if you want to see more about the publications they have and the books they have, go to AmatoBooks.com, AmatoBooks.com. And our winner for that is, let's see here, it's Jeff Thrash in Pennsylvania. Jeff Thrash, Pennsylvania. So congratulations, Jeff, and I'm sure you'll enjoy that subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. Now we're going to give away a copy of Matt's book, and Selectivity, The Theory and Method of Fly Fishing for Fussy Trout, Salmon, and Steelhead, courtesy Headwaters Books. And I just clear my queue here quickly so I can get the answer. So the way you play this game is you go to our homepage. You'll see the text box on the page there. Put in your answer, your name, your location, and the first person that gets the answer correct will win. So here's the question. Beginning of the show, Matt named three of what he thought were the toughest Spring Creek fisheries in the U.S. that he's fished. What are those three Spring Creeks? So we're just waiting away here, Matt. And then we'll be done. I think I know the right answers, but I want to make sure that we get this. Let's see here. Not too hard, guys? Come on. Gals? Okay. Ooh, I think you missed it by one, David, in Minneapolis. He said Delaware, Au Sable, and La Torp.
You know what?
He's got two of them right.
I say go for it.
You say give him the book?
Absolutely. The Asable could be a bear. The Latour is a bear. Delaware is a bear. The one, Silver Creek, is the one in Idaho. That's the
right
monster. But I'd say he got pretty close. Absolutely. Enjoy the book, buddy.
Okay. David Willeman, Minneapolis, you just got yourself a book, and you're near plenty of Spring Creeks up there, as Matt described earlier in the show, so you should enjoy it. David, in that same text box or in an email to info@askaboutflyfishing.com, send me your mailing address. I have your name. I have your email address here, so I just need your mailing address, and we'll get you taken care of. So thanks for playing, I hope you guys enjoyed the show. Matt, thanks again for being on the show. I know you squeezed us in here between all kinds of different things going on, but I appreciate it. And as always, you delivered and at 150%. So thanks for being on with us.
Roger, you got a great program. It's always a pleasure to be there, and more coming. So stay tuned. And then, again, I'm going to be in Pennsylvania and New York in September, so hopefully people come out and see my clinics. And thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, great. Well, have a good day on the river tomorrow. And
thank you, sir.
Okay.
Good night. Take care. Bye.
Our next broadcast will be on August 3rd, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern. And that show, I'm going to interview Charlie Craven. And the topic for the show will be tying nymphs. Charlie Craven is a top-selling signature fly designer for Umpqua Feather Merchant. He's also a great teacher. So if you want to learn a bunch of great fly tying techniques, join us for a in-depth study of tying nymphs. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, Headwater Books, Watermaster, Flats, and Flats Time Charters for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, and we'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website, askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements, so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.